There is no one you can go to in New Orleans who can make a decision for a majority of students or even a third of the students. We are not a school system the way people in the United States think about it. I call us a system of schools.
We're going to start out with Leslie talking about what's happened here in the state of Louisiana and in New Orleans more specifically, and how education is really changing since Hurricane Katrina. Then we're going to move to Arwen talking about her experience in Arizona with BASIS and as being a provider in the charter school movement. And then I'm going to wrap up and talk a little bit about what this all means for the nation. What does President Obama tell us about charter schools? What are some of the challenges and national trends, really briefly? And then we'll take your questions. So thank you very much, and welcome Leslie Jacobs.
Good morning. Thank you all very much for being here. Welcome to New Orleans. We had perfect weather just for you. I hope you have time to enjoy it. I've been involved, as mentioned, in education reform for at least 25 years now. And when Katrina struck New Orleans, or as we say here, when the levees broke, New Orleans was arguably, at that point in time, the worst performing school district in the United States. It was academically, financially, and morally bankrupt. Louisiana is a very low performing state, and it was the lowest performing district in the state. It had failed to do its Y2K conversion properly and couldn't balance an end of year nor an end of month since December 1999. The Fed to come in with a $50 million Title I audit finding, and it was teetering. It really was bankrupt at the time. And there was just rampant fraud and corruption such that the FBI opened up an office inside the central office. There's been over 20-some-odd convictions, including the then president of the Orleans Parish School Board. What we did in, there are many states that have failed urban school districts. What we did in Louisiana was very different. I had really watched states trying to take over failed urban school districts. And the typical model is, we'll swap your guys for my guys. And out goes your superintendent, in comes mine. Out comes your board, and if it's replaced, in comes mine. And this is a mayoral or gubernatorial control or some combination. And I would argue it's very hard to sit back and say 5 or 10 years later there has been transformational change in urban school districts. There has been usually reform around the edges, is what there has been. If there was financial problems, they're cleaned up, and they may get a little bit of academic gains, but there's not transformational change. We tried a different model. I had served on the New Orleans School Board and had gone to the then governor and said, you know, corruption's easy to fix, but systemic incompetence is not. We don't want it. Let's take the failing schools away from the school district modeled after Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So the Recovery School District was formed prior to Katrina. It is recovery from academic failure. It was tied into our school accountability model. And in essence, we declared a school academically failed. We take that school from the local school board. And in doing so, it's no longer under that control. So the school board policies are stripped. The control of central office is stripped. All contracts, including the collective bargaining agreement, is stripped. And out comes the school, the building, the students, and the money, and the school gets to start over. So where are we today? There are 88 schools, 38,000 kids this year. There were 65,000 students before Katrina. You have let me back up. When Katrina happened, what we did is we amended the law. Pre-Katrina, there were 5 schools in the Recovery School District. They were all charter schools. After Katrina hit, we amended the law and we took over every school from the Orleans Parish School Board that was below the state average because we did not want them to reopen the schools. And you may say, why didn't you just take them all? Because we didn't want a constitutional challenge. So we took them below the state average. So they kept 16 schools. Their schools were almost all selective admission schools, which is why they were above the state average. And we took all of the others and reopened. And the Recovery School District in New Orleans post-Katrina has really had 2 functions. One is turning around chronically failing schools, and the other is actually rebuilding. We came back to no teachers, books, buildings, classrooms, etc. Today there are 88 schools, 51 of them are charter. 61% of our students go to charter schools. Next year, I anticipate that number will be 70%. So we are incredibly different. There is no city like us. There is no one you can go to in New Orleans who can make a decision for a majority of students or even a third of the students. We are not a school system the way people in the United States think about it. I call us a system of schools because the charter schools, again, have control over their time, people, and money. And so the critics say, well, it's not fair that schools are competing, and we call it co-opetition. They are competing, but it's a movement going on in New Orleans, and I'll come back to that. There is really a sense that we have the opportunity to show the country how urban education can be totally redesigned, and there is a commitment to that that transcends just a school, you know, quote, competing against another school. So we now are the most market-driven system in the United States, and in addition to what I say here, we also have a voucher program that's going to be educating somewhere, I think, between 1,200 and 2,000 students next year. But every single school is a school of choice. There are no attendance zones or catchment areas are called different things in different parts of the country. But you pick, parent picks the school. They are not automatically assigned to any school. There's competition for employees. All charters are employers at will, but they set their own salary schedule, the benefit schedule. Some are in the teacher retirement program. Some have 403Bs, I think they are called. So there's competition, absolutely, for employees. There's elimination of all employee protections. As I mentioned, charters are employer at will, but after we took over the school board then eliminated the collective bargaining agreement. So I think we're probably the only urban school district in the United States that has actually terminated a collective bargaining agreement. What's fascinating, having been in school reform for so long, is you will hear schools always complaining about central offices' failure to deliver services to them. Well, what's going on in New Orleans is the service providers now have to compete for the business because charter schools are making those decisions at the ground level. So they were unhappy with Sodexo and food service. They went out and got their own food service providers. They didn't like the company providing bus service. They went out and groomed some local bus service providers. And this is done with really total transparency. Louisiana has, depending upon the year, the number one or number two ranked school accountability system in the country. And these are public schools. The kids take the test. All this information is made public. And what I really like is money follows the student. We have a state law that limits the amount of overhead the authorizer can take to 2%. So 98 cents of every dollar follows that student to a school. The results are truly compelling. Now, every state has their numbers, and I won't go through what these numbers mean. But we've risen about 13 points in that time, and the state's risen only about 3.5 points. And understand, from 05 to 09, there was no school year here in 05, 06. In 06, 07, we didn't start on time because we didn't have buildings, books, and teachers. Our kids came back having lost months or years of schooling, and I can't stress to you the emotional, mental health issues these children came back with. So if we had just held our own, that would have been a moral victory. Instead, we have grown more than any other district in the state, except for five very small parishes, and in very small numbers, they have a movement that is hard to capture in the larger districts. Kids meeting the promotional standard. Again, our promotional standard probably translates to an ACT score of about 17. I can't put in SAT, I can put SAT. But this is the improvement in our promotional standard since the state action. Probably, to me, what is most exciting is pre-Katrina, two-thirds of the schools were failing. Today, we're up to only one-third, in essence, failing. And when the scores come out this year, I believe it will be a much smaller percentage. Within the next year or two, we will have no more failing K-8 schools, which will be very exciting. For all the conversation, it is very hard to turn around a failing school. from a charter, from a traditional. I mean, there's very scarce data on being able to do that, and we're doing that with kids who really are very distressed. And when I get this slide up in and show it inside Louisiana, there's total skepticism that somehow or other we've changed the kids. Our kids are 90% African American, 2% Hispanic, and 85% free and reduced lunch. Charter performance, they are significantly outperforming the traditional schools. I went and looked at the schools that opened August 2006. They're of the charters, 25 out of 30 are one star or higher, meaning they are not failing. Of the traditional schools, only 5 of 21 are one star or higher. I convened a group of school leaders, and you'll have someone on the panel, but to say really what is going on, and I convened a group of people who had worked both in Orleans Parish schools and in charter schools. And probably for them, that autonomy could not be understated. It was a nimbleness of being able to respond to problems. A combination of both innovation and consistency. New Orleans had gone through, I think, 8 superintendents in 10 years, and every one of them came in with their different program. The charter school can say, this is what we're gonna do in curriculum and instruction and have consistency, yet if it's not working, they can innovate. And you have a board that has to have that individual focus on how is that school performing. As an elected member of the school board, I had 20 some odd schools in my district. I couldn't even visit them all. This way, there is a board, and they want to know, what are you doing that school to drive performance? Probably the thing that most impressed me was ownership. In the 25 years in ed reform, I call it the blame game. You sit traditional educators in a room, pick anyone you want, and within moments, they're going to tell you it's the kid, it's the parents, it's the poverty, it's the neighborhood, it's the teacher's union, it's the principal, it's the school board, it's the superintendent, it's the parent. Just goes around in a circle. In the hours I spent with these school leaders, there was never a word of blame game. If we're not reaching this child, what do we have to do to fix it? They own it, and they don't go to anybody else. So the whining, you just don't hear the whining. It's such a pleasure. Key ingredients. I would tell you that charters are not a panacea. I'm a strong charter advocate, but I believe the Credo study that was done out in California, where charters generally do not outperform traditional schools. I think of charters as a fulcrum, as a leverage point. If you're just an average principal, you're going to do just as well or better in a traditional school system where they pick the curriculum, you're not responsible for the non-academic functions, and you just run your school and they shore you up. But if you're good or better, you're going to run a much better school charter because you're freed up from the mediocrity of that central office. But you have to choose wisely. And so in Louisiana, when we hired NACSA, the National Association of Charter School Authorizers, to design our process. And that first year, only 6 of 44 applicants were selected. We have probably the strongest accountability measure of any state board in the country on these charters. They have to meet certain performance measures or their charter will not be renewed. We'll see if the board has the backbone this coming year, because there are going to be some politically connected charters, one or two that need to have their charter non-renewed, and we'll see if they do it. Human capital. Charters are a change of governance. They're only going to drive change in instruction if they bring with them quality educators. That school leadership is critical. And again, what you have going on in New Orleans is some self-selection. The same way we feel the United States has a culture, because people, we attracted risk takers who were willing to cross the Atlantic Ocean many moons ago. New Orleans is attracting risk takers who want to come here and be part of the movement and are willing to take a failing school and turn it around. So we have a very strong entrepreneurial mindset within our charter school movement. Teach for America, the new teacher project, Teach NOLA, they will have 1 in 3 educators in our schools this coming school year. We have totally upgraded the quality of teaching. And what helps us is we're hot. I mean, you've just been in the city. We suffered brain drain forever, and part of that spike in entrepreneurship is the young demographic we are attracting here in Louisiana. And we were listed by this demographic as one of the top 10 cities. And so I'll also tell you, talent attracts talent. I'm watching good school leaders and good teachers urge their friends who are in TFA and have finished their 2-year stint to come on down to New Orleans, because it's an exciting place to be in education. We've replaced central office. I mean, again, money follows the child. There is no money for central office. Now, the nonprofits are providing a lot of support. We're the only city in the country where a nonprofit really houses the contract for Teach NOLA TFA. We're struggling. We're getting better, but charters learning how to deal with special needs kids appropriately. When you are 70% of the schools, you cannot cherry pick. You are the system of schools, so you must serve all children. Critical, if you're looking to replicate this, is charter school incubation. Good charter schools just don't grow on trees. We got a lot of foundation support to go out, and we would do a national recruitment for charter school leaders and would incubate them for a year, pay them their salary, and give them a year to plan their school. And then advocacy. The challenge we have this session is just stunning me up in Baton Rouge. I wish they would just all go home. But because we are such a threat to the traditional system, I mean, there is a bill now requiring any new charter school, a certain type of charter, to have a vote of the people in the district where they live. They're doing the death of a thousand cuts, all these anti-charter people now, and because, gosh, we might succeed. I'll end on this one. Because I thought you'd find it very interesting. We took the schools over against the will of the people of New Orleans. Trust me, I got a lot of that flack. But what's fascinating is we are now the status quo. I love it. There is strong support for charters. So 74% of voters supported charters and 62% supported converting the remaining traditional schools into charters. Strong support for choice. What was fascinating in this poll is one of the very early questions, besides are you a registered voter, is what do you think is better in New Orleans post-Katrina? And it was an open-ended question. One in four voters, the highest response, said education. And for me, which is a very big issue for our local governance, is the schools. There's a vote this year about what to do with the schools. And in essence, two-thirds say, either don't return them to the school board, at least not for 3 to 5 more years. And so we have a public will to not return the schools to the Orleans Parish School Board immediately. Thank you.
As Lisa mentioned, I am the Director of Program Development and Support for Basis Educational Group, and we are an education management organization that runs 2 charter schools in Arizona currently, and we serve students in grades 5 through 12. Basis Tucson is our flagship campus. It was founded in 1998, and 10 years later, in 2008, it was named the number one school in the country by Newsweek magazine. It's also ranked on the top 10 by U.S. News and World Report out of over 22,000 high schools. Our second campus, Basis Scottsdale, was ranked the number one Arizona high school for overall academic performance, and that was just 1 year after we opened for high school grades. This year, Basis actually became the feature of a documentary called 2 Million Minutes, The 21st Century Solution. And it's a documentary that highlights Basis as a solution for education reform in America in the 21st century. This has been a really exciting year for our schools. We've actually also had visits from CNN, The Economist, The Washington Post, and the political odd couple, Al Sharpton and Newt Gingrich. And what I tell all of our visitors is that the Basis philosophy is really very simple. We set high standards for our students, and we hold the students and the teachers accountable for meeting them. We hire teachers who are experts in the discipline they teach, and we've created an incentive-based pay structure. And when you look at the international picture, it becomes very clear that the U.S. just isn't cutting it when it comes to education. The PISA exam, which is an exam given to 15-year-old students across the world, shows that the U.S. students are performing below the OECD average in mathematics and science literacy. And the Basis philosophy is really to bring the level of American education up to the international standards. So I'm just going to give you a brief overview of our curriculum. Beginning in 5th grade, we teach Latin and classics. In 6th grade, students begin taking the sciences as separate subjects, so they take chemistry, biology, and physics each week. We have a mandatory economics class for all 8th grade students. By 9th grade, all of our students are in at least pre-calculus. Within their high school program, students take at least 8 AP courses and 6 AP exams in order to graduate, and they can actually all graduate by the end of their 11th grade year with enough credits to go on to any college in the state. We hold our students accountable for actually mastering the material in each grade level through a comprehensive exam system. So students have to pass their comprehensive exam in all core subjects, as well as all of their courses, in order to move on to the next grade level. We also hold our teachers accountable. We have one-year teaching contracts, and if a teacher doesn't deliver, he isn't going to be asked back the next school year. However, if he does deliver, we have a performance-based pay structure, so we award salary supplements and bonuses to teachers for their students' results on exams throughout the year. Next year, we're actually going to be opening up our third school in Oro Valley, and we have plans and aspirations to open more schools both in Arizona and around the country in the coming years. So what I'm going to talk a little bit about today is just what we're looking for in these other states in order to draw us there. One of the most important factors for us comes down to teacher certification. And again, when you look at the international picture, the nations that are performing the best on this PISA exam tend to draw their teachers from the top 10, 20, maybe 30% of college graduates. And then you look at the US, and the picture here is quite different. Schools of education here tend to draw students from the bottom third of their cohort. And that's not to say that there aren't good people in schools of education, but more likely than not, you're not going to get someone who is at the top of their class. Luckily, in Arizona, we've been given a way around this. Arizona doesn't actually require charter school teachers to be certified. It requires that they're highly qualified. And that's measured according to the number of courses they take in a given subject. So what this does for us is it allows us to actually look for people who have degrees in the discipline they're teaching. So they might not be well steeped in pedagogy, but they know their subject. And what it really comes down to is, do you want a 7th grade chemistry teacher who knows stoichiometry inside and out, or do you want someone who knows the pedagogy but is really just keeping one or two chapters ahead of the students? So I'd recommend for most states just to drop the certification requirement entirely, and that kind of gets us out of this problem of having to reform our schools of education. We can get around it. We have knowledgeable people who are willing to do the work. Another important policy issue is the ability to exceed state standards. Kind of sounds like a no-brainer, but believe it or not, we actually had to file a lawsuit against the Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction a few years back about this very issue. And what they were telling us, they had tried to set grade level standards for the social studies curriculum. So they were pretty much saying, you have to teach US history in grade X, world history in grade Y, and so on. The founders of the school happened to be libertarian economists, and they didn't like that very much, so we filed a lawsuit. We wound up settling and are actually able to teach our curriculum as it was designed. But the real lesson here is that it's the school leaders who need to have control over the curriculum. You can gauge whether or not it's working and what best practices are through test results, through research, whatever the case might be. But it's the school leaders who can see what's working and who can make adjustments quickly if something isn't working. And that actually leads directly into my next point, which is that states should give charter schools a waiver from most of the rules and regulations that govern traditional public schools. A lot of states place restrictions on class sizes, on outsourcing non-instructional services. And the whole idea behind the charter school movement is really to create laboratories of reform and options beyond what were available in traditional districts. And when you limit charter schools to the same policies that traditional public schools are operating under, you're pretty likely to get the same results. States should also be wary of overburdensome notification and reporting requirements. This one's very true to my heart because it's part of my job, so I spend a lot of time on the phone with bureaucrats. In the past, we've actually been required to do reporting on funding we're no longer receiving. But more often than not, what it comes down to is just turning in paperwork that doesn't relate to student achievement, it doesn't relate to the financial stability of the school, and frankly, it has no base in state law. And this is all happening at the same time when legislators are saying that we need to be spending more money in the classroom. But the bureaucrats keep piling on more regulations, which increases the administrative workload and actually takes resources away from the classroom. One of my biggest pet peeves is when states actually require teachers to be associated with a traditional school district. And what this really is code for forcing them to be members of a union. Charter schools who are operating on the idea that teachers are going to be held accountable probably aren't going to be drawn to these states. Next, and this is an important one, charter school authorizers. We need to have authorizers beyond just traditional school districts. Many states just limit districts to the ones who can sponsor charter schools. And the problem with that, obviously, is that school districts have an inherent disincentive against sponsoring charter schools. It's just easier not to have to compete. So opening up options for state boards for charter schools, departments of education, universities, there are a lot of other options as far as authorizing entities. Another important factor is that operators really are going to be drawn to states that have relatively equitable funding for charter schools and traditional schools. In Arizona, charter schools actually receive about $2,000 less per pupil than traditional schools. And Arizona is generally kind of at the bottom of the ranking when it comes to state funding to begin with. So at BASIS, we're operating on a budget of roughly $6,300 a student. So that's about half what you're getting in Massachusetts, Delaware, Vermont, New Jersey, you name it. And I think we're doing pretty well on that budget. So I am a firm believer that most schools can do less with more. I think BASIS is an example of that. But there does come a point where, in order to maintain your educational quality, you do have to have a certain amount of resources. And I think Arizona is walking that very thin line right now. There's really no reason that a student who's attending a charter school should receive less funding than, you know, the exact same student who would have chosen a traditional public school. Finally, states that want good charter schools should make it easy for charter schools to come and easy for them to replicate. It's really not that complicated. You want good schools, you make it easy for them to come, you make it easy for them to replicate. So in closing, I don't think that there's any state in the country that actually has all of these different characteristics, but obviously the more permissive the policy environment, the more likely you are to attract top performing schools.
So what does New Orleans and the experience that BASIS has had mean for the rest of the nation and where we are in the school choice movement? I've said before at Reason Weekend that I'm an optimist, and I continue to be very optimistic about where education is going in the United States. And sometimes that's hard when we realize, you know, that $100 billion was given basically to backfill the status quo for public schools with very little reform in the stimulus spending recently. It can be difficult sometimes when you look at, you know, the public employee wars over pensions and, you know, the unwillingness of teachers' unions when states are facing $20 billion deficits that they would much rather lay off 40,000 teachers in a state than work to reform pensions or have wage freezes or do something that would maintain the quality of their education because they're just not willing to give on the rules and the collective bargaining rules. It can be distressing. But on the brighter side, there are now 5,000 charter schools in the nation. And there's over 15 communities where more than 20% of the students are now enrolled in charter schools. So the market share in concentrated geographic areas of charter schools is really growing. So for example, take a place like Detroit. You hear a lot about the negative things about the Detroit public schools. And you know, they've been bankrupt, they've been failing for decades. The kids are struggling, but what you often don't hear is that 40% of the kids in Detroit are in charter schools, and they have a higher quality alternative. That right now, Detroit has come up with a plan to be a lot like New Orleans and to basically have a recovery-style governing board that will turn over all of the schools to competing charter schools based on very stringent standards. And I would argue that really, if Detroit hadn't hit rock bottom and gone bankrupt, and served kids badly for so long, they wouldn't really be in the position where the charter school movement had the opportunity to come in and take over 40% of the students, or where they have the opportunity now to make the entire school district better. So there are bright spots in the United States. You know, in the nation, charter schools do right now receive only about 61% of school funding. There's been about 5,200 charter schools, and of them, 657 schools have closed. So some charter schools have closed, and this really is the asset of the charter school movement. Paul Pasterick, who's the state superintendent here in Louisiana, likes to say that in the state they have a philosophy of try again. And what that means, if a school tries to improve the education, new school leaders, a school is chartered, but after a given period of time, if they fail, there's nothing wrong with closing that school and starting again. And it's funny, like people in the education establishment often say, oh, but kids will be displaced. They'll have to leave their school. Their school will be closed. It will be a terrible thing. And yet they see nothing wrong with something like Centennial High School in Compton, California, where I live, that hasn't been accredited for 30 years, that has 3,000 students, and not one of them who graduates meets the California State University standards to enroll in a university, a state university in California. There's nothing wrong with that, but we can't close a school and displace students. So I would argue that we really need to work on realizing the difficulty of turning around failing schools and not being afraid to close schools and start again, because as long as there's high quality opportunities surrounding those closed schools and the kids have somewhere to go, you know, closing schools needs to be a very important part of this. At the Reason Foundation, and my philosophy, and I think I speak for all of us, is really that we do have to work on the piece that Leslie highlighted, where the money follows the child. And that's really what's key here, is that we need to be agnostic about the school label. In the school choice movement, we really get caught up on, is it a charter school, a voucher, a tax credit, a public school? You know, what is the purest form of free market education that we can find? And I think we need to move away from that and move toward the idea that we're probably not going to get the money, where 99% of the money is controlled in public education, billions of dollars by the education establishment. Overnight, that's probably not going to become a free market where the parents take responsibility and fund their own child's education. So somehow, we have to work with the way that the system is now, and we have to attach that money to the backs of children. And we have to be agnostic about the label of the school, that really what we're talking about is the parents walking with their feet to any kind of school that offers high quality, measured by school performance and accountability, financial accountability, because after all, we are taxpayers, and we do want our schools to be financially and academically accountable. So if we're using public money, we need to really not look at the label, but look at what the school does and get rid of residential assignment in the United States. We need to move toward a system like New Orleans, where we have not a school system, but a system of schools nationally that are run by all kinds of different providers, and the funding is attached to the children, not to the district, not to the board, not to the state, not to the school. It's the only way the school gets money is if they can get kids to enroll there. And that's really where I think we are moving. And even within public schools, I mean, for example, New York City, all 1,700 schools are now open enrollment schools. They no longer have residential assignment. The money follows the child. The school leaders all have autonomy over making decisions about personnel. And, you know, they're new at it. There's plenty of kinks still to work out. But you can't underestimate how huge it is that you have a city with 1,700 schools where a child can choose any school in the city. You could not have said that anywhere in the United States 10 years ago. So we've made huge improvements, and there's a lot of cities, Baltimore, Chicago, San Francisco, Oakland, Philadelphia just voted to do this. Los Angeles is planning to phase this in the next 3 years, where really everyone is moving to move away from residential assignment. So I think, you know, that is a very good sign, and we're on the right track with and New Orleans, I hope, will become the model for the nation. And certainly academically, they're showing the performance to go along with the choice. So it's very promising. And then I just want to kind of end on, though, a more sober kind of challenge for the charter school movement. And this is that we really are at a tipping point. And when Arwin talks about what kind of regulatory framework or what makes BASIS likely to go somewhere and open a charter school? You know, President Obama has talked about turning around 5,000 of the lowest performing schools in the United States. And this lies the great opportunity for the charter school movement and the great risk for the charter school movement. And I'm gonna use Los Angeles. You saw the video earlier of the parent revolution in Los Angeles. And this underscores both the risk and the opportunity in Los Angeles. So basically what happened there is they have a parent union or a parent grassroots group, and thousands of parents, both charter school parents and non-charter school parents, decided that LA Unified has had the biggest school building program in America, where they have had 2 multi-billion dollar bonds, and they've literally built hundreds of new schools. And the parents and the charter school movement said, wait a minute, why should the traditional schools get all those new buildings? And the parents said, we want some of that new capital to open charter schools. And so they had a school choice resolution that passed the school board that both the new buildings, 50 new schools, and then 200 underperforming schools would be allowed to competitively bid to run those schools in the future. And so we've just gone through the first round of that in LA. And basically the school board and the superintendent got to look at the plans and the proposals and approve the who would run the schools. So the first 30 schools were competitively bid. And it was about half were new schools and half were low-performing district schools that needed to be operated by someone else. And 2 things happened that are very discouraging for the idea of school turnarounds. First of all, there's just very little evidence in the United States that traditional school districts can change things enough to turn around schools without closing the school and starting fresh with a different operator. So really what you want to see happen with schools that have been failing for a long time is that they close completely and they start with a completely new culture, operational strategy, so that it's not the same people in the building saying, no, no, this time we're going to get it right. So unfortunately, in Los Angeles, in this first round of proposals to run the schools, the first thing that happened is that up front, things that Arwin School would never put up with, the district decided that the charter schools, in order to compete, needed to follow the collective bargaining agreement of the district, that they needed to accept all of the district's front office services so that they would have to have special education, transportation, food service, that they would have to buy that back. So basically they said, yes, we'll give these schools to charter schools, but only if you accept all the rules that we already have in Los Angeles. So the first thing that happened is that surprisingly, and to the charter school's credit, very few charter schools bid on the first 30 schools. And they were surprised. They said, wait a minute, charter schools aren't serious in Los Angeles. They don't really want to run the schools, but it was a question of integrity. They couldn't run the schools their way under those conditions, so most of them didn't bid. But then the second thing that happened is where they did bid on the new schools and the low-performing schools, the school board and the district chose not the charters, but teacher-led initiatives. So the teachers and the schools that had been failing for years came up with their own plans to reorganize their schools and run them. Now, under the right conditions, this isn't guaranteed for failure because some of these schools now are going to control the money and have autonomy, and some of them probably will be successful. But the most discouraging thing of all is that Garfield High School, where Jamie Escalante made Stand and Deliver, very famous, and Jamie Escalante recently just died. And Garfield High School is one of the lowest performing high schools in LA. Instead of being taken over by a better plan, their plan was approved with reservations. And actually 12 of the teacher-led plans were approved with reservations because they were so bad that the school board was not willing to commit to them and to put their stamp of approval on them. So I'm just going to kind of wrap with that is, as this creates great opportunity, there's a lot of pressure for these charter schools to change their business models and to give in to school districts in order to win the contracts and the money. And that's really what happened in Philadelphia with the school privatization. Edison schools and other operators, you know, they call it a privatization failure, but really they never respected the integrity of their business model to begin with, and they accepted all kinds of constraints from the district, and then they weren't successful. And so this really is the risk. Charter schools hopefully will be able to resist the temptation of the money and the students and the rapid growth and stick with the integrity of their business model and continue to use New Orleans as a model and not how things are going so far in Los Angeles. But I do think we have a revolution and that in 10 to 20 years, things will look much different for public education.